Repression. David G. Myers, social psychologist, Hope College, author, Psychology, 10th edition. In today's Freud-influenced popular psychology, repression remains big. People presume, for example, that unburying repressed traumas is therapeutic. But do we routinely exile our painful memories? Traumatic memories are often repressed, agree 4 in 5 undergraduates and members of the American and British general public in recent surveys reported by a University of California, Irvine research team. Actually, say today's memory researchers, there's little evidence of such repression and much evidence of its opposite. Traumatic experiences, witnessing a loved one's murder, being terrorized by a hijacker or a rapist, losing everything in a natural disaster, rarely get banished into the unconscious, like a ghost in a closet. Traumas more commonly are etched on the mind as persistent, haunting memories. Moreover, extreme stress and its associated hormones enhance memory, producing unwanted flashbacks that plague survivors. "You see the babies," said one Holocaust survivor. "You see the screaming mothers. It's something you don't forget." The scientist-therapist memory war lingers, but it's subsiding. Today's psychological scientists appreciate the enormity of unconscious, automatic information processing, even as mainstream therapists and clinical psychologists report increasing skepticism toward repressed and recovered memories. Mental illness is nothing but brain illness. Joel Gold, Clinical Associate Professor of Psychiatry, NYU Langone Medical Center, co-author, with Ian Gold, Suspicious Minds. Ian Gold, Canada Research Chair in Philosophy and Psychiatry, McGill University, co-author, with Joel Gold, Suspicious Minds. In 1845, Wilhelm Griesinger, author of the most important psychiatry textbook of the day, wrote, "What organ must necessarily and invariably be diseased where there is madness? Physiological and pathological facts show us that this organ can only be the brain." Griesinger's truism is regularly reiterated in our own time because it expresses the basic commitment of contemporary biological psychiatry. The logic of Griesinger's argument seems unassailable. Severe mental illness has to originate in a physiological abnormality of some part of the body, and the only plausible candidate location is the brain. Since the mind is nothing over and above the activity of the brain, the disordered mind is nothing more than a disordered brain. True enough. But that's not to say that mental disorders can or will be described by genetics and neurobiology. Here's an analogy. Earthquakes are nothing over and above the movements of a vast number of atoms in space. But the theory of earthquakes concerns tectonic plates and says nothing at all about atoms. The best scientific explanation of a phenomenon depends on where human beings find comprehensible patterns in the universe and not on how the universe is constituted. God may understand earthquakes and mental illness in terms of atoms, but we may not have the time or the intelligence to do so. It's not a radical idea that understanding and treating brain disorders sometimes has to move outside the skull. Your heart hurls an embolus into your brain. You might now be unable to produce or understand speech, move one half of your body, or see half the world in front of you. You've had a stroke, and your brain is now damaged. The cause of your brain illness didn't originate there, but in your heart. Your physicians will do what they can to limit further damage to your brain tissue and perhaps even restore some of the function lost due to the embolism. But they'll also try to diagnose and treat your cardiovascular disease. Are you in atrial fibrillation? Is your mitral valve prolapsed? Do you need a blood thinner? And they won't stop there. They'll want to know about your diet, exercise regimen, cholesterol level, and any family history of heart disease. Severe mental illness is also an assault on the brain, but, like the embolus, It may sometimes originate outside the brain. Indeed, psychiatric research has already given us clues suggesting that a good theory of mental illness will need concepts that make reference to things outside the skull. Psychosis provides a good example. A family of disorders, psychosis is marked by hallucinations and delusions. The central form of psychosis, schizophrenia, is the psychiatric brain disease par excellence. But schizophrenia interacts with the outside world, in particular, the social world. Decades of research has given us robust evidence that the risk of developing schizophrenia goes up with the experience of childhood adversity, like abuse and bullying. Immigrants are at about twice the risk, as are their children, and the risk of illness increases in a near linear fashion with the population of your city and varies with the social features of neighborhoods. Stable, socially coherent neighborhoods have a lower incidence than neighborhoods that are more transient and less cohesive. We don't yet understand what it is about these social phenomena that interacts with schizophrenia, but there's good reason to think they're genuinely social factors. Unfortunately, the environmental determinants of psychosis go largely ignored, but they provide opportunities for useful intervention. We don't yet have a genetic therapy for schizophrenia, and antipsychotic drugs can be used only after the fact and aren't nearly as good as we'd like them to be. Although the decade of the brain produced a great deal of important research into brain function, and the NIH's Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies initiative will do so too, almost none of our efforts have yet helped, or are likely to help, patients suffering from mental illness or those who treat them. However, reducing child abuse and improving the quality of the urban environment might well prevent some people from ever developing a psychotic illness at all. Whatever it is about the social determinants of psychosis that make them risk factors, they must have some downstream effect on the brain, otherwise they wouldn't increase the risk of schizophrenia. But they themselves are not neural phenomena any more than smoking is a biological phenomenon because it's a cause of lung cancer. The theory of schizophrenia will have to be more expansive, therefore, than the theory of the brain and its disorders. That a theory of mental illness should involve the world outside the brain is no more surprising than that the theory of cancer has to involve cigarette smoke. Yet what is commonplace in cancer research is radical in psychiatry. The time has come to expand the biological model of psychiatric disorder to include the context in which the brain functions. In understanding, preventing, and treating mental illness, we will rightly continue to look into the neurons and DNA of the afflicted and unafflicted. To ignore the world around them would be not only bad medicine, but bad science.
Psychogenic illness. Beatrice Galam, Professor of Medicine, University of California, San Diego. For entree to the mindset behind psychogenic illness, one need go no further than the humble hiccup. Consider the published case of the 31-year-old epileptic retarded institutionalized male with refractory hiccups so severe that his hiccups caused melena, doctor lingo for black tarry stool, from bleeding high in the gastrointestinal, GI, tract. The blood oxidizes in transit, turning dark. When a tube was inserted in his nose for some incidental reason, the man's hiccups ceased. Clearly, punishment had cured the hiccups, from which it followed that their cause was psychogenic. Thereafter, each time the poor man's hiccups commenced, attendants first menaced him with the nasogastric tube, which never worked, then molested the back of his throat with it, reliably aborting the hiccup bouts. After some months of nasopharynx torment, the man's hiccups resolved, and so did the melena, proving their punishment worked. Except hiccups don't cause melena, and nasopharyngeal stimulation doesn't cure hiccups by punishment. Manifestly, a GI woe caused the melena, simultaneously irritating the input arm to the hiccup reflex, the vagus nerve, which traverses the GI tract. GI afflictions are the chief cause of persistent hiccup, and nasopharynx stimulation, the most effective reported cure for hiccups, working equally in unconscious people, presumably oblivious to punishment, with anesthetic-induced hiccup. Like many hiccup cures, this stimulates the vagus higher in its trajectory, interrupting the reflex. One defective case does not invalidate a phenomenon. Surely other psychogenic hiccup reports rest on sturdier foundation. A woman's hiccups were psychogenic because, it was announced, they were precipitated by an emotionally significant event. The touted trigger? Her daughter's age. The age she had been when she herself was abused. Hiccup is the obvious outcome. Causal affirmation rested on a history of medical maladies triggered by emotionally significant events. A fall on ice was chalked up to an emotional event in the general temporal vicinity. Then there was her history of morbid fear of uterine cancer, so powerful it caused uterine bleeding, then led to uterine cancer itself. The possibility that her fear of uterine cancer was justified, indeed triggered by the abnormal uterine bleeding, which was actually due to the cancer that was later diagnosed, was not considered. In other instances, the psychogenetic defense rested on cessation of hiccups with sleep. Proof positive. Except for pesky counterexamples, a reading of the literature would expose. Like the boy whose recurrent hiccups initially resolved with sleep, but then didn't. And then his medullary brain tumor was diagnosed. The medulla exerts tonic inhibition to the hiccup reflex. Damage disrupts this inhibition. A hiccup epidemic in a hospital ward was clearly mass psychogenic illness. Many contracted hiccups, so susceptibility to psychic contagion must have high penetrance. How then have friends, family, and hospital roommates of the many other persistent hiccup cases been spared? Might there be another explanation? How about actual contagion? Streptococcus singultus had caused epidemic hiccup in the past and could be passaged in rabbits, causing them to hiccup. No effort to hunt for such a cause was made. Singultus is hiccup in medicalese. A review of this literature in days of yore, graduate school, revealed no report of psychogenic hiccup in which positive evidence corroborated a psychogenic cause. Worse, the foundation for psychogenic illness itself was supposition. There was no delineation of mechanisms by which such effects putatively occur, much less demand to prove such mechanisms were operating. Nor was there a clear exposition of what precisely was meant by psychogenic, which morphs for the convenience of the expositor. Note, I don't presume that physical ailments cannot have psychological triggers. Some alternative medicine approaches proffer putative means to discriminate which cases do, furnish testable hypotheses, and effect cures, a standard beyond that which mainstream medicine adopts. Many psychogenic epithets have surrendered to evidence. Ulcers were psychogenic until Helicobacter pylori and NSAIDs usurped the blame. So was most low back pain. By 1987, Finnish researcher Madi Jokama had it partly right. Little is known about its low back pain's etiology, its natural history, and its treatment. This may explain why the myth exists that low back pain is often psychogenic. This pre-science was undermined, or peer reviewers courted, when he added that those afflicted with back pain were, however, apt to harbor neuroses, and on top of that, weak egos. A revision, he proclaimed, of the prior view, in which conversion hysteria and psychosis dominated causes of back pain. It's remarkable how the advent of workplace ergonomics helped gird weak egos. The newly minted somatic symptom disorder is the latest take on psychogenic illness, anointed in the last incarnation of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. This is the tome that guides haruspication, psychiatry. This dispenses with even the one requirement, lack of another cause, recognizing the pesky propensity for that lack to be sometimes horresco referens, remedied, thus discrediting the doctor who declared the problem psychogenic. Now the doctor can skip the tiring pretense of actually looking for a cause, and if one is found anyway, he still saves face by virtue of the patient remaining impugned. The condition is cured only when the patient shuts up about her symptoms. This helps the doctor and the healthcare system, never mind the patient. The emperor never had clothes. The psychogenic designation is logically vacuous, not meaningfully defined, so not falsifiable, grounded in petitio principii, singular reasoning, and functions as an assault. It impedes a search, when warranted, for legitimate conditions, breaches patient-doctor trust, effectively abandons the patient, and blames him for his affliction, while also casting a pall of mental infirmity. It adds to, rather than mitigates, the patient's travails, antithetical to the dictum, primum non nocere, first do no harm, that ought to guide medical care. The psychogenic designation has long presumed that for any other condition a standard of evidence must be met. Yet for psychogenics, no standard is demanded. Ipsy dixit. Proof by suggestion. Who could believe that? Someone who suffers from the delusion of psychogenic illness. It's all in the doctor's head.
Crime entails only the actions of criminals. Eduardo Salcedo Albarrán, philosopher, director, Scientific Vortex, Incorporated. It sounds logical to say that to understand crime, you must focus on criminals and felonies. But advances in social science give us reason to reconsider this idea. Heroin is trafficked from Turkey across the Kapitan Andreevo security checkpoint in Bulgaria to be sold in the richest countries of the European Union. More illegal drugs arrive in Europe from South America via the countries of East Africa. In South Africa, racketeers, private security firms, and arms dealers conduct businesses together, erasing the boundary between legal and illegal financial transactions. In Mexico, ferrous material, hydrocarbon condensate, and illegal drugs are trafficked and sold to legal and illegal firms and to individuals in the United States. Los Zetas and other criminal networks operating in Central America engage in human trafficking, kidnapping, and murdering of migrants before they cross the U.S. border. Between 2006 and 2010, some of those criminal networks laundered $881 million through a single legal bank inside the U.S. In 2012, the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice reported that the same bank failed to monitor $9.4 billion in the same period. Whoever has sent or received wire transfers, both inside and outside the U.S., we'll find it difficult to understand how one of the most important banks worldwide could fail to monitor $9.4 billion. In all these cases, the participation of legitimate public servants, private citizens, and corporations is essential. In all these cases, bankers, attorneys, police, border officials, flight controllers, mayors, governors, presidents, and politicians co-opt and are co-opted by crime. Sometimes they're the instruments. Sometimes they're the structural bridges connecting legality and illegality. They provide information, money, protection, knowledge, and social capital to criminal networks, a reason to define them as unlawful actors. However, they operate within legal agencies, a reason to define them as lawful actors. They seem lawful and unlawful at the same time. They're what we call gray actors, located and operating on the border between legality and illegality. They don't appear in the charts of criminal organizations, although they provide input for successful criminal operations. Despite the significant role of these gray actors, social scientists interested in analyzing crime usually focus only on criminals and criminal actions. They tend to study crime through qualitative and quantitative data relating only to those dark elements, ignoring the fact that transnational and domestic crime is carried out by people who don't interact solely through criminal actions. This is a hyper-simplified approach because the dark elements are only the tip of the iceberg of global crime. Their approach also assumes that society is a digital binary system in which the good and the bad guys, the us and them, are perfectly distinguishable, a useful distinction in penal terms when simple algorithms, if individual X executes action Y, then X is a criminal, orient judicial sentencing decisions. However, in sociological, anthropological, and psychological terms, this line is more difficult to define. If society is a digital system, it's certainly not a binary one. This doesn't mean that crime is relative, or that we are all criminals because we are indirectly related to someone who commits a crime. It means only that defining and analyzing crime shouldn't consist of simple binary criteria like belonging to a group or committing a single action. Such criteria are useful, applied to the boss of a criminal group or the specific act of shooting someone, but most of the time, affiliations and actions are complex and fuzzy. Thus, as a society, we rely on and trust the intuition of a judge, someone who, despite simple algorithms, considers such factors as intention, context, and effect when pronouncing sentence. And this is why we aren't designing software for convicting criminals and passing sentences. Such things are complicated. Current tools for organizing and assessing large amounts of data are useful for understanding the complexity of crime. Formulating explicative models through social network analysis or predictive models through machine learning that integrate several variables are examples of useful procedures. However, those procedures usually miss classic distinctions between right and wrong or ignore the fragmentation of scientific disciplines. Good and evil, right and wrong, legal and illegal, these are all context-driven concepts. Economists, psychologists, anthropologists, and sociologists are often uncomfortable with the mixture of concepts required for analyzing complex behavior. Facing this complexity means integrating categories from many scientific domains, moving easily between macro and micro characteristics, even adopting new models of causality. This sounds like an impossible enterprise in traditional scientific realms. Social scientists are morally obliged to use the most accurate tools of observation when analyzing data and phenomena because their observations inform the design and enforcement of policies. If inaccurate tools are used, bad decisions are made, as when a doctor diagnoses a tumor just by measuring body temperature. When the science we're studying is about understanding human trafficking, mass murders, or terrorism, using the best tools and providing the best inputs means preserving lives. It's therefore time to retire the idea that understanding crime means understanding the minds and actions of criminals. We must also retire other naive concepts, such as organized crime, and the idea that any current nation or government evolves without any criminal influence. These are nicely simplified concepts that work well in theoretical models in the classrooms and journals that manage to evade the complexity and vagueness of society. But if we don't deal with society's true complexity using the diverse tools provided by science, we'll have to deal with that complexity in the streets and the courtrooms, like it or not. Statistical Significance. Charles Seif, Professor of Journalism, New York University. Former Journalist, Science. Author, Virtual Unreality. It's a boon for the mediocre, the credulous, the dishonest, and the merely incompetent. It turns a meaningless result into something publishable, transforms a waste of time and effort into the raw fuel of scientific careers. It was designed to help researchers distinguish a real effect from a statistical fluke, but it has become a quantitative justification for dressing nonsense up in the mantle of respectability. And it's the single biggest reason that most of the scientific and medical literature isn't worth the paper it's written on. When used correctly, the concept of statistical significance is a measure to rule out the vagaries of chance. Nothing more, nothing less. Say, for example, you're testing the effectiveness of a drug. Even if the compound is completely inert, there's a good chance, roughly 50% in fact, that patients will respond better to your drug than to a placebo. Randomness alone might imbue your drug with seeming efficacy. But the more marked the difference between the drug and the placebo, the less likely it is that randomness alone is responsible. A statistically significant result is one that has passed an arbitrary threshold. In most social science journals and the medical literature, an observation is typically considered statistically significant if there's less than a 5% chance that pure randomness can account for the effect you're seeing. In physics, the threshold is usually lower, often 0.3%, 3 sigma, or even 0.00003%, 5 sigma. But the essential dictum is the same. If your result is striking enough to pass that threshold, it's given a weighty label, statistically significant. Most of the time, though, the term isn't used correctly. If you look at a typical paper published in the peer-reviewed literature, you'll see that never is just a single observation tested for statistical significance, but instead handfuls or dozens or even 100 or more. A researcher looking at a painkiller for arthritis sufferers will look at data to answer question after question. Does the drug help a patient's pain? Does it help a patient with knee pain, with back pain, with elbow pain, with severe pain, with moderate pain, with moderate to severe pain? Does it help a patient's range of motion, quality of life? Each one of these questions is tested for statistical significance and typically gauged against the industry standard 5% rule. That is, there's a 5% chance, 1 in 20, that randomness will make a worthless drug seem effective. But test 10 questions, and there's a 40% chance that randomness will indeed deceive you when answering one or more of these questions. And the typical paper asks more than 10 questions, often many more. It's possible to correct for this multiple comparisons problem mathematically, though it's not the norm to do so. It's also possible to fight this effect by committing to answer just one main question, though in practice such primary outcomes are surprisingly malleable. But even these corrections often can't take into account numerous effects that can undermine a researcher's calculations, such as how subtle changes in data classification can affect outcomes. Is severe pain a 7 or above on a 10-point scale, or is it an 8 or above? Sometimes these issues are overlooked. Sometimes they're deliberately ignored or even manipulated. In the best-case scenario, when statistical significance is calculated correctly, it doesn't tell you much. Sure, chance alone is relatively unlikely to be responsible for your observation, but it doesn't reveal anything about whether the protocol was set up correctly, whether a machine's calibration was off, whether a computer code was buggy, whether the experimenter properly blinded the data to prevent bias, whether the scientists truly understood all the possible sources of false signals, whether the glassware was properly sterilized, and so on. When an experiment fails, it's more than likely that the blame rests not on randomness, on statistical flukes, but instead on a good old-fashioned screw-up somewhere. When physicists at CERN claim to have spotted neutrinos moving faster than light, a Six Sigma level of statistical significance and an exhaustive check for errors wasn't enough to convince smart physicists that the CERN team had messed up somehow. The result clashed not only with physical law, but with observations of neutrinos coming from supernova explosions. Sure enough, a few months later, the flaw, a subtle one, finally emerged, negating the team's conclusion. Screw-ups are surprisingly common in science. Consider, for example, the fact that the Food and Drug Administration inspects a few hundred clinical laboratories each year. Roughly 5% of inspections come back with findings that the laboratory is engaged in significant objectionable conditions and practices so egregious that its data are considered unreliable. Often, these practices include outright fraud. Those are just the blindingly obvious problems visible to an inspector. It's hard to imagine that the real number of lab screw-ups isn't double or triple or quintuple that. What value is there in calling something statistically significant at the 5% or 0.3% or even 0.00003% level if there's a 10% or 25% or more chance that the data is gravely undermined by a laboratory error? Even the most ironclad findings of statistical validity lose their meaning when dwarfed by the specter of error, or worse yet, fraud. Nevertheless, even though statisticians warn against the practice, a one-size-fits-all finding of statistical significance is all too often taken as a shortcut to determine whether or not an observation is credible or a finding is publishable. As a consequence, the peer-reviewed literature is littered with statistically significant findings that are irreproducible and implausible, absurd observations with effect sizes orders of magnitude beyond what's even marginally believable. The concept of statistical significance has become a quantitative crutch for the essentially qualitative process of whether or not to take a study seriously. Science would be much better off without it. Scientific interference via statistical rituals. Gerd Gigerenzer, psychologist, director, Center for Adaptive Behavior and Cognition, Max Planck Institute for Human Development, Berlin, author, Risk Savvy. As a young man, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz had a beautiful dream: to discover the calculus that could map every single idea in the world into symbols. Such a universal calculus would put an end to all scholarly bickering. Every passionate-edge discussion, for one, could be swiftly resolved by dispassionate calculation. Leibniz optimistically estimated that a few skilled people should be able to work the whole thing out in 5 years. Yet nobody, Leibniz included, has yet found that holy grail. Nonetheless, Leibniz's dream is alive and thriving in the social and neurosciences. Because the object of the dream has not been found, ersatz objects serve in its place. In some fields, it's multiple regression. In others, Bayesian statistics. But the champ is the null ritual. 1. Set up a null hypothesis of no mean difference or zero correlation. Don't specify the predictions of your own research hypothesis. 2. Use 5% as a convention for rejecting the null. If significant, accept your research hypothesis. Report the result is p is less than 0.05, p is less than 0.01, or p is less than 0.001, whichever comes next to the obtained p-value. 3. Always perform this procedure. Not for a minute should anyone think this procedure has much to do with statistics proper. Sir Ronald Fisher, to whom it has been wrongly attributed, in fact wrote that no researcher should use the same level of significance from experiment to experiment. The eminent statisticians Jerzy Neyman and Egon Pearson would roll over in their graves if they knew about its current use. Bayesians, too, have always detested p-values. Yet open any journal in psychology, business, or neuroscience, and you're likely to encounter page after page with p-values. To give just a few illustrations, in 2012, the average number of p-values in the Academy of Management Journal, the flagship empirical journal in its field, was 116 per article, ranging between 19 and 536. Typical of management, you might think. But 89% of all behavioral, neuropsychological, and medical studies with humans published in 2011 in Nature reported p-values only, without considering effect size, confidence interval, power, or model estimation. A ritual is a collective or solemn ceremony consisting of actions performed in a prescribed order. It typically involves sacred numbers or colors, delusions to avoid thinking about why one is performing the actions, and fear of being punished if one stops doing so. The null ritual contains all these features. The number 5% is held sacred, allegedly telling us the difference between a real effect and random noise. In fMRI studies, the numbers are replaced by colors, and the brain is said to light up. The delusions are striking. If psychiatrists had any appreciation of statistics, they would have entered these aberrations into the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Studies in the U.S., U.K., and Germany show that most researchers don't, or don't want to, understand what a p-value means. They confuse it with the probability of a hypothesis, that is, p parens data ho with p parens ho data, or with some other bit of wishful thinking, such as the probability that the data can be replicated. Startling errors are published in top journals. For instance, an elementary point is that in order to investigate whether two means differ, we should test their difference. What shouldn't be done is to test each mean against a common baseline, such as neural activity increased with training, p is less than 0.05, but not in the control group, p is greater than 0.05. A 2011 paper in Nature Neuroscience presented an analysis of neuroscience articles in Science, Nature, Nature Neuroscience, Neuron, and the Journal of Neuroscience, and showed that although 78 articles did as they should, 79 used the incorrect procedure. Not performing the ritual can provoke great anxiety, even when it makes absolutely no sense. In one study, the authors' names are irrelevant, Internet participants were asked whether there was a difference between heroism and altruism. The great majority felt so. 2,347 respondents, 97.5%, said yes, 58 said no. What did the authors do with that information? They computed a chi-square test, calculated that C2 parens 1 equals 2178.60, p is less than 0.0001, and came to the astounding conclusion that there were indeed more people saying yes than no. One manifestation of obsessive-compulsive disorder is the ritual of compulsive hand-washing, even if there is no reason to do so. Likewise, researchers adhering to the null ritual perform statistical inferences all the time, even in situations where there's no point. That is, when no random sample was taken from a population or no population was defined in the first place. In those cases, the statistical model of repeated random sampling from a population doesn't even apply, and good descriptive statistics is called for. So even if a significant p-value has been calculated, it's not clear what population is meant. The problem isn't statistics, but its mistaken use as an automatic inference machine. Finally, just as compulsive worrying and hand-washing can interfere with the quality of life, the craving for significant p-values can undermine the quality of research. Finding significant theories has been largely replaced by finding significant p-values. This surrogate goal encourages such questionable research practices as selectively reporting studies and conditions that worked, or excluding data after looking at their effect on the results. According to a 2012 survey in Psychological Science of some 2,000 psychologists, over 90% admitted to having engaged in at least one of these or other questionable research practices. This massive borderline cheating in order to produce significant p-values is likely more harmful to progress than the rare cases of outright fraud. One harmful outcome is a flood of published but irreproducible results. Genetic and medical research using big data has encountered similar surprises when trying in vain to replicate published findings. I don't mean to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Statistics offers a highly useful toolbox for researchers, but it's time to get rid of statistical rituals that nurture automatic and mindless inferences. Scientists should study rituals, not perform rituals themselves. The Power of Statistics. Emmanuel Derman, Professor of Financial Engineering, Columbia University, former head, Quantitative Strategies Group, Equities Division, Goldman Sachs, author, Models.Behaving.Badly. I grew up among physicists whose modus operandi is to observe the world, experiment with it, develop hypotheses and theories and models, suggest further experiments, and use statistics to analyze the results, thereby comparing mental imaginings with actual events. Statistics is simply their tool for confirmation or denial. But nowadays the world, and especially the world of the social sciences, is increasingly in love with statistics and data science as a source of knowledge and truth itself. Some people have even claimed that computer-aided statistical analysis of patterns will replace our traditional methods of discovering the truth, not only in the social sciences and medicine, but in the natural sciences too. We must be careful not to get too enamored of statistics and data science and thereby abandon the classical methods of discovering the great truths about nature. And man is nature, too. A good example of the classical power is Kepler's 17th century discovery of his second law of planetary motion, which is in fact less a law than the recognition and description of a pattern. Kepler's second law states that the line between the sun and a moving planet sweeps out equal areas in equal times. This deep symmetry of planetary motion implies that the closer a planet is to the sun, the more rapidly it moves along its orbit. But notice that there is no line between a planet and the sun. Kepler's still astonishing insight required examining Tycho Brahe's data, a long mental struggle, a burst of intuition, use an invisible line, and then checking his hypothesis. Data, intuition, hypothesis, and finally, comparison with data is the time-honored process. Kepler's second law is in fact a statement of the conservation of angular momentum that followed later from Newton's theories of motion and gravitation. Newton's theories were readily and immediately accepted because Kepler's three verified laws could be derived from them. John Maynard Keynes wrote of Newton 300 years later, "I fancy his preeminence is due to his muscles of intuition being the strongest and most enduring with which a man has ever been gifted." Statistics, the field itself, is a kind of Caliban, sired somewhere on an island in the region between mathematics and the natural sciences. It's neither purely a language nor purely a science of the natural world, but rather a collection of techniques to be applied to test hypotheses. Statistics in isolation can seek only to find past tendencies and correlations and assume they will persist. But in a famous unattributed phrase, correlation is not causation. Science is a battle to find causes and explanations amid the confusion of data. Let us not get too enamored of data science, whose great triumphs so far are mainly in advertising and persuasion. Data alone have no voice. There are no raw data, as Kepler's saga shows. Choosing what data to collect and how to think about them requires insight into the invisible. Making good sense of the data collected requires the classic conservative methods: intuition, modeling, theorizing, and then, finally, Statistics.
Reproducibility. Victoria Stoughton, computational legal scholar, assistant professor of statistics, Columbia University. I'm not talking about retiring the abstract idea or its place in scientific discourse and discovery. Instead, I'm suggesting redefining specifically what is meant by that word and using more appropriate terminology for the various research environments scientists work in. When Robert Boyle brought the concept of reproducibility into scientific discourse in the 1660s, what comprised scientific experimentation and discovery was twofold: deductive reasoning, such as mathematics and logic, and Francis Bacon's relatively new machinery of induction. How to verify correctness was well established in logical deductive systems, but verifying experimentation was much harder. Through his attempts with Robert Hooke to establish a vacuum chamber, Boyle made a case that inductive or empirical findings, those arising from observing nature and then drawing conclusions, must be verified by independent replication. It was then that empirical research came to be published with sufficient detail regarding procedure, protocols, equipment, and observations such that other researchers could repeat the procedure and presumably, therefore, the results. This conversation is complicated by today's pervasive use of computational methods. Computers are unlike any previous scientific apparatus, because they act as a platform for the implementation of a method rather than directly as an instrument. This creates additional instructions to be communicated as part of Boyle's vision of replicable research, the code and digital data. The communication gap hasn't gone unnoticed in the computational science community, and somewhat reminiscent of Boyle's day, many voices are calling for new standards of scientific communication, this time to include digital scholarly objects such as data and code. Irreproducible computational results from genomics research at Duke University in recent years focused attention on this issue and led to a report by the Institute of Medicine of the National Academies recommending new standards for clinical trials approval for computational tests arising from computational research. The report recommended, for the first time, that software associated with the computational test be fixed at the beginning of the approval process and thereafter made sustainably available. A subsequent workshop at Brown University on reproducibility in computational and experimental mathematics, of which I was a co-organizer, produced recommendations about the appropriate information to include when publishing computational findings, including access to code, data, and implementation details. Reproducibility in this context should be relabeled computational reproducibility. Computational reproducibility can then be distinguished from empirical reproducibility, or Boyle's version of the appropriate communication for non-computational empirical scientific experiments. Making this distinction is important, because traditional empirical research is running into a credibility crisis of its own regarding replication. As Nobel laureate and edgy Daniel Kahneman has noted in reference to the irreproducibility of certain psychological experiments, I see a train wreck looming. What's becoming clear is that science can no longer be relied on to generate verifiable facts. In these cases, the discussion concerns empirical reproducibility rather than computational reproducibility. But calling both types reproducibility muddies the waters and confuses discussion aimed at establishing reproducibility as a standard. I believe there is, at least, one more distinct source of irreproducibility: statistical reproducibility. Addressing issues of reproducibility through improvements to the research dissemination process is important, but insufficient. We also need to consider new measures to assess the reliability and stability of statistical inferences, including developing new validation measures and expanding the field of uncertainty quantification to develop measures of statistical confidence and a better understanding of sources of error, especially when large multi-source data sets or massive simulations are involved. We can also do a better job of detecting biases arising from statistical reporting conventions established in a data-scarce, pre-computational age. A problem with any one of these three types of reproducibility, empirical, computational, and statistical, can be enough to derail the establishing of scientific facts. Each type calls for different remedies. Improving existing communication standards and reporting, empirical reproducibility, making computational environments available for replication purposes, computational reproducibility, and the statistical assessment of repeated results for validation purposes, statistical reproducibility, each with different implementations. These are broad suggestions. And each type of reproducibility can demand different actions depending on the details of the scientific research context. But confusing these very different aspects of the scientific method will slow our resolution of Boyle's old discussion that started with the vacuum chamber.
The Average. Nicholas A. Christakis, Goldman Family Professor of Social and Natural Science, Yale University, co-author with James H. Fowler, Connected. Ever since the landmark invention of diverse statistical techniques 100 years ago that let us properly compare the difference between the averages of two groups, we have deluded ourselves into thinking that it's such differences that are the salient, and often the only, important one between groups. We've spent a century observing and interpreting such differences. We've become almost obsessed, and we should stop. Yes, we can reliably say that men are taller than women on average, that Norwegians are richer than Swedes, that first-born children are smarter than second-born children. And we can do experiments to detect tiny differences in means between groups exposed and unexposed to a virus, or between groups with and without a particular allele of a gene. But this is too simple and too narrow a view of the natural world. Our focus on averages should be retired, or if not retired, given an extended vacation. During this vacation, we should catch up on another sort of difference between groups which has gotten short shrift. We should focus on comparing the difference in variance, which captures the spread or range of measured values between groups. Part of the reason we've focused so much on the average is that the statistical tools for computing and comparing averages are so much easier and well-developed. It's much harder to compare whether the variance of one group is different from the variance of another. But this calls to mind the joke about the drunk searching for his keys on his knees under a lamppost because the light is better there. Drunk with statistical power, we've persuaded ourselves that the mean of a distribution is its most important property. But often it's not. For example, we've focused on the differences in average wealth between groups, whether the United States is richer than other countries and what might have caused this, or whether bankers make more money than consultants and how this affects the professional choices of graduating college students. But the distribution of wealth in the groups may be equally important in explaining collective and individual outcomes and choices. Even if the U.S. and Sweden have the same average income, roughly speaking, the variance in income is much higher in the U.S. Income inequality is greater. And this fact, rather than any difference in means between the groups, may help explain what happens to people in these societies. For example, it may be better for the health of a group, and on average, for the health of the individuals within it, for the group to have a more equal distribution of income, even if the average income is somewhat lower. We might wish for more equality at the expense of wealth. Here's a hypothetical example leading to the opposite practical conclusion about inequality. When forming a crew of sailors for a sailboat, what would be best? To have all 10 of the sailors have the same level of myopia with mean vision of 2200? Or to have a group of sailors in which 9 had even worse vision, but 1 had perfect vision? The average vision could be the same in both groups, but for the purposes of sailing the boat effectively, and for the survival of all aboard, it might be better to have more rather than less inequality. We might wish for more inequality at the expense of vision. Or consider a medical example of how variance is important. There may be 2 conditions with equal average prognoses, say advanced AIDS and advanced liver cirrhosis. But the doctors may offer do not resuscitate orders to AIDS patients at much higher rates. It's tempting to conclude that doctors are more eager to avoid resuscitating AIDS patients, perhaps for discriminatory reasons. But the real reason may be that the variance in survival in the AIDS group is much higher, and there may be many more patients in that group who will die imminently. The doctors may be oriented to this fact rather than to the average survival of the 2 groups. They may reason that they can wait to offer DNR orders to the cirrhosis patients. A familiarity with variance would also allow us to make sense of the famously controversial hypothesis regarding why there are more male math professors at major universities. The mean overall math aptitude among men and women might be the same, but the variance in men might be higher. If so, this would mean that there are more men at the very bottom of the distribution, and indeed boys are roughly 3 times more likely to be mentally disabled than girls, but also that there are more men at the upper end of the distribution. When we focus mainly on the mean, we miss the chance to observe interesting and important things about the world. And a restricted view has adverse practical as well as scientific implications. Do we want a richer, less equal society? Do we want educational programs to increase the equality of test scores or the average? Will a cancer drug that makes some patients live longer and kills others sooner still be preferred by patients, even if it has no effect on average survival? To really understand the relevant trade-offs, we must acquire not only the tools, but also the vision to focus on variance. Standard Deviation. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, Distinguished Professor of Risk Engineering, NYU Polytechnic School of Engineering. Author, Inserto, Anti-Fragile, The Black Swan, Fooled by Randomness, and The Bed of Procrustes. The notion of standard deviation has confused hordes of scientists. It's time to retire it from common use and replace it with the more effective one of mean deviation. Standard deviation, STD, should be left to mathematicians, physicists, and mathematical statisticians deriving limit theorems. There's no scientific reason to use it in statistical investigations in the age of the computer, as it does more harm than good, particularly with the growing class of people in social science mechanistically applying statistical tools to scientific problems. Say someone just asked you to measure the average daily variations for the temperature of your town, or the stock price of a company, or the blood pressure of your uncle over the past 5 days. The 5 changes are negative 23, 7, negative 3, 20, negative 1. How do you do it? Do you take every observation, square it, average the total, then take the square root? Or do you remove the sign and calculate the average? For there are serious differences between the 2 methods. The first produces an average of 15.7, the second 10.8. The first is technically called the root mean square deviation. The second is the mean absolute deviation, MAD. It corresponds to real life much better than the first, and to reality. In fact, whenever people make decisions after being supplied with the standard deviation number, they act as if it were the expected mean deviation. It's all due to a historical accident. In 1893, the great Carl Pearson introduced the term standard deviation for what had been known as root mean square error. The confusion started then. People thought it meant mean deviation. The idea stuck. Every time a newspaper has attempted to clarify the concept of market volatility, it has defined it verbally as mean deviation, yet produced the numerical measure of the higher standard deviation. But it's not just journalists who fall for the mistake. I recall seeing official documents from the Department of Commerce and the Federal Reserve partaking of the conflation, even regulators in statements on market volatility. What's worse, Daniel Goldstein and I found that a high number of data scientists, many with PhDs, also get confused in real life. It all comes from bad terminology for something non-intuitive. By a psychological bias Danny Kahneman calls attribute substitution, some people mistake MAD for STD because the former is easier to come to mind. 1. MAD is more accurate in sample measurements and less volatile than STD since it's a natural weight, whereas standard deviation uses the observation itself as its own weight, imparting large weights to large observations, thus overweighing tail events. 2. We often use STD in equations, but really end up reconverting it in the process to MAD, say in finance for option pricing. In the Gaussian world, STD is about 1.25 times MAD, that is, the square root of pi over 2. But we adjust with stochastic volatility, where STD is often as high as 1.6 times MAD. 3. Many statistical phenomena and processes have infinite variance, say the popular Pareto 80-20 rule, but have finite and very well-behaved mean deviations. Whenever the mean exists, MAD exists. The reverse, infinite MAD and finite STD, is never true. 4. Many economists have dismissed infinite variance models, thinking these meant infinite mean deviation. Sad but true. When the great Benoit Mandelbrot proposed his infinite variance models 50 years ago, economists freaked out because of the conflation. It is sad that such a minor point can lead to so much confusion. Our scientific tools are way too far ahead of our casual intuitions, which starts to be a problem with science. So, I close with a statement by Sir Ronald A. Fisher. The statistician cannot evade the responsibility for understanding the process he applies or recommends. And the probability-related problems with social and biological science do not stop there. There are bigger problems with researchers using statistical notions out of a can without understanding them and babbling N of 1 or N large or this is anecdotal for a large black swan-style deviation, mistaking anecdotes for information and information for anecdote. The majority use regression in their papers in prestigious journals without quite knowing what it means and what claims can and cannot be made from it. Because of little check from reality and lack of skin in the game, coupled with a fake layer of sophistication, social scientists can make elementary mistakes with probability, yet continue to thrive professionally. Statistical Independence. Bart Kosko, Professor of Electrical Engineering and Law, University of Southern California. Author, Noise. It's time for science to retire the fiction of statistical independence. The world is massively interconnected through causal chains. Gravity alone causally connects all objects with mass. The world is even more massively correlated with itself. It is a truism that statistical correlation doesn't imply causality. But it is a mathematical fact that statistical independence implies no correlation at all. None. Yet events routinely correlate with one another. The whole focus of most big data algorithms is to uncover just such correlations in ever larger data sets. Statistical independence also underlies most modern statistical sampling techniques. It's often part of the very definition of a random sample. It underlies the old-school confidence intervals used in political polls and in some medical studies. It even underlies the distribution-free bootstraps or simulated datasets that increasingly replace those old-school techniques. White noise is what statistical independence should sound like. The hisses and pops and crackles of true white noise samples are all statistically independent of one another. This holds no matter how close the noise samples are in time. That means the frequency spectrum of white noise is flat across the entire spectrum. Such a process does not exist because it would require infinite energy. That hasn't stopped generations of scientists and engineers from assuming that white noise contaminates measured signals and communications. Real noise samples aren't independent. They correlate to some degree. Even the thermal noise bedeviling electronic circuits and radar devices has only an approximately flat frequency spectrum, and then over only part of the spectrum. Real noise doesn't have a flat spectrum, nor does it have infinite energy. So real noise is colored pink or brown, or some other strained color metaphor that depends on how far the correlation reaches among the noise samples. Real noise is not and cannot be white. A revealing problem is that there are few tests for statistical independence. Most tests tell at most whether two variables, not the data itself, are independent. And most scientists would be hard-pressed to name even them. So the overwhelming common practice is simply to assume that sampled events are independent. Just assume that the data are white. Just assume that the data are not only from the same probability distribution, but also statistically independent. An easy justification for this is that almost everyone else does it, and it's in the textbooks. This assumption has to be one of the most widespread instances of groupthink in all of science. The reason we so often assume statistical independence isn't its real-world accuracy. We assume statistical independence because of its armchair appeal. It makes the math easy. It often makes the intractable tractable. Statistical independence splits compound probabilities into products of individual probabilities. Then, often a logarithm converts the probability product into a sum because it's easier still to work with sums than products. And it's far easier to lecture would-be gamblers that successive coin flips are independent than to conduct the fairly extensive experiments with conditional probabilities required to factually establish such a remarkable property. That holds because, in general, a compound or joint probability always splits into a product of conditional probabilities. The so-called multiplication rule guarantees this factorization. Independence further reduces the conditional probabilities to unconditional ones. Removing the conditioning removes the statistical dependency. The Russian mathematician Andrei Markov made the first great advance over independence or whiteness when he studied events that statistically depend only on the immediate past. That was over a century ago. We still wrestle with the math of such Markov chains and find surprises. The Google search algorithm rests in large part on finding the equilibrium eigenvector of a finite Markov chain. The search model assumes that Internet surfers jump at random from web page to web page, much as a frog hops from lily pad to lily pad. The jumps and hops aren't statistically independent, but they are probabilistic. The next web page you choose depends on the page you're now looking at. Real web surfing may well involve probabilistic dependencies reaching back to several visited websites. It's a good bet that the human mind isn't a Markov process. Yet relaxing independence to even one-step or two-step Markov dependency has proved a powerful way to model diverse streams of data, from molecular diffusion to speech translation. It takes work to go beyond the simple Markov property, where the future depends only on the present and not on the past. But we have ever more powerful computers that do just such work. And many more insights will surely come from the brains of motivated theoreticians. Giving up the crutch of statistical independence can only spur more such results. Science needs to take seriously its favorite answer. It depends. Certainty, absolute truth, exactitude. Richard Saul Wurman, founder, TED Conference, TED Med Conference, architect, cartographer, author, Information Architects. A wonderful diagram is the approximate theory of the sun-centered solar system of heliocentrism done by Nicolaus Copernicus, which he published in 1543. It would never be published in any academic circles today, because it is not correct. The orbits aren't circular, they're elliptical. They're not all on the same plane, and the diagram is completely disproportionate and does not represent the distances between the planets or from the planets to the sun. It's a diagram of approximation. It's a diagram that gave permission for others, as Tycho Brahe released his documentation and his measurements so that Kepler could come up with a more approximate notion of our planetary universe incorporating more accurate geometries. What I'm suggesting be retired are those three terms, and what I suggest to be embraced is more academic leeway in theories of approximation that give permission for others to see and discover new patterns. The Illusion of Scientific Progress. Paul Sappho, Technology Forecaster, Consulting Associate Professor, Stanford University. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, "Let Newton be," and all was light. Alexander Pope. The breathtaking advance of scientific discovery has the unknown on the run. Not so long ago, the creation was 6,000 years old, and heaven hovered a few thousand miles above our heads. Now, Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and the observable universe spans 92 billion light years. Pick any scientific field, and the story is the same, with new discoveries and new life-touching wonders arriving almost daily. Like Pope, we marvel at how hidden nature is revealed in scientific light. Our growing corpus of scientific knowledge evokes Teilhard de Chardin's arresting metaphor of the noosphere, the growing sphere of human understanding and thought. In our optimism, this sphere is like an expanding bubble of light in the darkness of ignorance. Our optimism leads us to focus on the contents of this sphere, but its surface is more important, for that's where knowledge ends and mystery begins. As our scientific knowledge expands, contact with the unknown grows as well. The result is not merely that we've mastered more knowledge, the sphere's volume, but that we've also encountered an ever-expanding body of previously unimaginable mysteries. A century ago, astronomers wondered whether our galaxy constituted the entire universe. Now they tell us we probably live in an archipelago of universes. The science establishment justifies its existence with the big idea that it offers answers and ultimately solutions. But privately, every scientist knows that what science really does is discover the profundity of our ignorance. The growing sphere of scientific knowledge is not Pope's night-dispelling light, but a campfire glow in the gloom of vast mystery. Touting discoveries helps scientists to secure funding and gain tenure, but perhaps the time has come to retire discovery as the ultimate measure of scientific progress. Let us measure progress not by what is discovered, but rather by the growing list of mysteries that remind us of how little we really know. This concludes This Idea Must Die by John Brockman. Narrated by David Colacci and Susan Erickson. Copyright 2015 by Edge Foundation, Incorporated. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Edge Foundation, Incorporated, care of Brockman Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2015 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.